Are you ready for Far Middle Time? It's that weekly dose of rational thought. This is your host, Nick Deolius, and it is good to be with you once again. Okay, we first aired this episode August 7th, and it's hot and humid across much of the nation. It's not exactly great running weather, but in places like Vancouver, British Columbia, it's nicer and more conducive to running. Now, where am I going with this? Well, the Far Middle research team did a little investigating back to 1954 on August 7th in Vancouver. And something historic happened there in the world of sport. More of an ABC-wide world of sports event, I would say. This one involving track and field. And it has lessons well beyond track and field. Even the elite entities, such as the Harvard Business Review, sees lessons about what we're about to dedicate and discuss beyond sports. For example, lessons to be applied in the world of business and in the field of innovation. On August 7th in 1954, there was a much anticipated race for the length of a mile between two competitors who had an amazing year running the mile leading up to that August and trying that year to complete the mile under the magical and then thought of unachievable goal of 4 minutes. Indeed, the Excalibur Sword in a Stone quest was to see if a human being could run the mile in under 4 minutes. And it wasn't but a few months prior to August 1954 that no one, let alone two runners in the same race, would ever be able to say they ran a mile in under 4 minutes. But 1954 proved all the experts and all the accepted thinking or wisdom wrong. The Brit Roger Bannister did it first, and he did it on the 6th of May in 1954 in the morning. He barely beat 4 minutes, coming in at a time of 3:59.4. And the Daily Telegraph at the time had described the sub-4-minute mile as sport's greatest goal. Recalling his burst of speed on the home stretch, Bannister said, "The earth seemed to move with me. I found a new source of power and beauty, a source I never knew existed." Yeah, the experts were proved wrong when Bannister made history in May of 54, and experts believed they knew the precise conditions under which the mark might be able to fall. They said it would have to be in perfect weather, 68 degrees and no wind, on a particular kind of track, hard, dry clay, and in front of a huge, boisterous crowd that would urge the runner on to be sort of able to post a best ever performance. But what actually happened? Bannister did it on a cold day, on a wet track, and at a small meet in Oxford, England, before a crowd of just a few thousand people. So not exactly the conditions either that the experts predicted would have to be there to even give a chance of breaking the mile in under 4 minutes. And that is so often the case, right, in the world records and the world of sport. When you see sort of a threshold being broken, it leads to even higher levels of performance. So once Bannister proved that a human could in fact run a mile in under 4 minutes, it left the world stunned, and it helped shatter a collective mental barrier. Before you knew it, Australian John Landy, the other guy who's going to be in that famous August 7th race in Vancouver that we're going to get to, he bettered Bannister's May record the following month in June with a time of 3:57.9. In the 3 years that followed that historic day in Oxford, a further 15 runners would go on to also perform the same feat of running a mile in under 4 minutes. So these two breaking the 4 minute barrier for the mile set the stage for that August race. Bannister and Landy head to head, the two men who broke the 4 minute barrier. Bannister first and Landy the world record holder at the time. Shaped up to be the race of the century, and it did not disappoint. Everybody was watching across the globe, millions on the new thing called TV. And here's how Sports Illustrated reported it back then by writer Paul O'Neill. This isn't the Pittsburgh Alcoa and Treasury Secretary legend Paul O'Neill, a different Paul O'Neill. But anyway, here it goes. I'm going to read from his story. "The art of running the mile consists, in essence, of reaching the threshold of unconsciousness at the instant of breasting the tape. It is not an easy process, even in a set-piece race against time, for the body rebels against such agonizing usage and must be disciplined by the spirit and the mind. It is infinitely more difficult in the atmosphere of competition, for then the runner must remain alert and cunning despite the fogs of fatigue and pain. His instinctive calculation of pace must encompass maneuver for position, and he must harbor strength to answer the moves of other men before expending his last reserves in the war of the home stretch. Few events in sport offer so ultimate a test of human courage and human will and human ability to dare and endure for the simple sake of struggle. Classically run, it is a heart-stirring, throat-tightening spectacle. But the world of track has never seen anything quite to equal the Mile of the Century, which England's Dr. Roger Gilbert Bannister won here last Saturday from Australia's world record holder, John Michael Landy. It will probably not see the like again for a long, long time. The duel of history's first four-minute milers, high point of the quadrennial British Empire in Commonwealth Games, was the most widely heralded and universally contemplated match foot race of all time. 32,000 people jostled and screamed while it was run in Vancouver's new Empire Stadium. Millions followed it avidly by television. It was also the most ferociously contested of all mile events. Despite the necessity of jockeying on the early turns and of moving up in a field of six other good men, Bannister ran a blazing 3 minutes 58.8 seconds and Landy 3 minutes 59.6 seconds. Thus, for the first time, two men broke 4 minutes in the same race. Runners are truly tested only in races with their peers. When the 4 minute mile was taken out of the laboratory and tried on the battlefield, Landy was beaten man to man, and Roger Bannister reigned again as the giant of modern track. Boy, I'll tell you, constant listeners, I love reading vintage sports journalism so much better than what we have today. I guess it might be true for a lot of journalism. Bannister and Landy have both pointed out that the crucial moment of the race, by the way, was the moment that Bannister decided to try to pass Landy. Landy looked over his left shoulder to gauge Bannister's position, and Bannister ran right past him on the right and never gave up the lead after that. Bannister won the race, but Landy still held the world record time, at least for the time being. So episode 168 is dedicated to that most famous of track and field races in Vancouver. On this premier day back in 1954, when not one, but two men broke the mile in under 4 minutes when they raced head-to-head. I should also point out that Roger Bannister is Dr. Roger Bannister, as in neurosurgeon. On the 50th anniversary of running the mile in under 4 minutes for the first time, Bannister was interviewed by the BBC, and I thought this was interesting. At the conclusion of the interview, Bannister was asked whether he looked back on the sub-4-minute mile as the most important achievement of his life. And Bannister replied that he instead saw his subsequent 40 years of practicing medicine and some of the new procedures that he introduced as being more significant. He is also Sir Roger Bannister, a truly accomplished individual. And his running of the mile made him quite famous. It shows, I guess, how specialization in life can pay off and how collective mindset and accepted consensus, they can shatter once an individual dares to challenge both. That's a lesson of our dedication that applies beyond competitive sport. One of the reasons why we spent a little bit of extra time on this dedication versus some prior dedications and episode spots. And it's why the Harvard Business Review and those types of entities and institutions across the globe, they study Bannister and the 4 minute mile quest. By the way, Haikem El-Gourouche is the current men's record holder with his time of just over 3 minutes and 43 seconds, while Faith Kipyegon has the women's record of just over 4 minutes and 7 seconds for the mile, in case you were wondering how today's athlete built upon and exceeded Bannister and Landy's feat. Now, let's make a connection to our next topic by contrasting. Contrasting the epic achievements and efforts of the milers coming to breaching the 4 minute mark and overcoming all those obstacles, what looked to be insurmountable odds to do the impossible and superhuman. Let's contrast that to the not so inspirational effort that we see across our federal government workforce these days. The federal bureaucracy as a workforce isn't exactly killing it or burning the midnight oil these days. In fact, the workforce is acting as if pandemic never ended. Came across data that led me to an opinion piece by Mark Fisher in the Washington Post, of all places, he did an excellent job summing up the current situation. When you compare it to what the expectations are for your job or how the real economy works, you might get upset after you hear this. So maybe that will serve as your trigger warning. Last August, 2023, that's 3.5 years after the pandemic sent millions of government workers home, President Biden's chief of staff told federal agencies to, using his term, aggressively execute a pivot back to in-person work. and largely nothing happened. So then this January, the same chief of staff at the White House emails the president's cabinet members. And in the email, he says agencies, again, using his words, are not where they need to be. I ask that you double down on your leadership to increase in-person work. Well, that doubling down didn't seem to do much because everyone remained remote on their couches or not working at all. So then this April, in a speech, the same chief of staff says publicly that we don't yet have the return to work levels that we should have across the federal government. Guess what? That didn't make a bit of difference to the administrative state either. They aren't listening and they don't care what the boss, including the president, instructs. And they certainly don't care about taxpayer return on investment with government. So a little perspective, because time flies and we lose track of how long we are talking about here. It has now been 4.5 years since COVID-19 altered the meaning and location of work for many Americans. Now, most people are back at their place of employment most of the time, but government workers remain largely at home, so much so that 17 out of 24 federal agencies were using only about 1/4 of their headquarters office space last summer. And that's from the Government Accountability Office in a report that they issued. That's killing government-heavy cities, especially, of course, good old Washington, D.C. It's killing businesses there, real estate, quality of life, and so on. And anyone can see it by wandering around D.C. on weekdays away from the tourist spots. You see shuttered storefronts along empty sidewalks, and it appears in many places to be a ghost town on Mondays and Fridays, and increasingly on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And that's why the president was urging workers to get back to work. But getting back to work messaging, it's not working, to play on words. And that's why the mayor of D.C. is asking and urging the White House to take decisive action, as the mayor put it, to get federal workers back to the office or, as she says, realign their vast property holdings for use by local government, nonprofits, businesses, or anyone willing to repurpose space. Now, that sounds like desperation, constant listeners. And the mayor should be getting desperate, as the policies that she supported for so long, they're now wrecking her city. And D.C. is not alone with that regard. There are big bucks at stake, by the way, your money as well. So taxpayers, they shell out about $5 billion a year to lease offices for federal employees, add another $2 billion a year to operate those buildings. That's more than, I think, 500 million square feet of office space that the federal government owns. That's $7 billion a year between those two numbers. And just under half of all workers, public and private sectors combined, now show up to their Washington, D.C. offices, and that's down somewhat from before the pandemic. So it wasn't like D.C. workers and government were showing up at the office every day before pandemic, but now it's even worse, and the unaccountable have become even less accountable. The numbers for public employees will shock you. Only 6% of federal workers are working full-time in their offices. 30% are fully remote. Some agencies are using less than 10% of their space. This is insane, and it has become ingrained culture within the federal government workforce. And the bureaucrat seems to love it, and they aren't budging. And they will self-delude to justify the slacking. An Office of Personnel Management report found that 84% of employees and managers within the federal government believe staying home improves the quality of their work. Yeah, right. Public sector unions, those inherently conflicted institutions, they are a big reason why federal government workers don't get off their couches anymore to go to work. Quote, people are coming back to the office more days, but to say the least, it is not very practical or popular. That came from the policy director for a public union that represents federal workers, about 750,000 of them. They worked heroically through the pandemic, this policy director said. The idea that they have to go into the office is absurd. So listen to that again. They worked heroically through the pandemic. The idea that they have to go into the office is absurd. Worked heroically through pandemic. Didn't we all then, by that definition? And what is it now called, since it's, what, 4.5 years after pandemic and everyone in the private sector that pays the federal bureaucracy's wages are back to in-person work? How do you explain this to a plumber or a truck driver or an oil field worker or a nurse or a factory worker, aka a taxpayer? And the idea of having government workers show up at the office to their job is absurd. Really? That's accountable government for you, I suppose, in 2024. Now, outrage about the workers' absence, it's starting to grow. You got two rational moderates in the Senate. How about that term? Rational moderates in the Senate. The way I defined it means it probably limits the choices down to a handful these days. But anyway, Senators Romney and Manchin sponsored a proposed law forcing bureaucrats to return to work. It's called the Back to Work Act. And get this, it would require feds to be in person at least 60% of the time. Yeah, we reached the point where Congress's attempt to inject accountability into the federal workforce to address chronic absenteeism and not showing up, it aims to get them into the office 60% of the time. OMG, are things broken in DC or what? The Biden administration continues to flop and flail at what has become a big optical headache. The chief of staff that I mentioned is starting to sound like a corporate HR head by now saying working in person is vital to build a strong culture and boosting productivity and training new employees. Yada, yada, yada. Yes, that's all true. But what do you do when the workforce refuses to show up and work for years? And let me remind everyone that President Biden promised in his 2022 State of the Union address, that's 2022, not 2024, that using his words, the vast majority of federal workers will once again work in person. Now, movement toward that goal remains glacial. Now, check that, movement on it is non-existent. Even glaciers move. Public unions, they call the shots and they aren't budging. Agencies have proposed boosting in-person attendance to anywhere from 2 days a week to 4 days a week, but some have cut their proposed minimums in response to union objections. Again, the public unions call the shots, not the president, not the cabinet, not Congress, and certainly not the taxpayer. And I suspect, as does Mr. Fisher in his op-ed, that the federal government bureaucracy management agrees with the public union bosses. You know, they don't want to work either and are happy, likely happy at least, to sit at home and do that remote thing. Everyone in the bureaucracy wins with a perpetually fully paid sabbatical while the taxpayer, aka the customer, gets you know what. Remote work and not working are now cultural and ingrained within the federal bureaucracy. And before someone objects, let's be adults and accept there's going to be a not insignificant portion of the federal bureaucracy that isn't working at all under this perpetually remote charade. And this isn't just happening in DC. It's happening everywhere the federal government tentacles reach, which is every major American city, every state, and every region. Unaccountable, absent, apathetic. No way to go about life or career or customer service, constant listeners. Now, Ronald Reagan once quipped that the scariest words known to humans is when someone shows up at your door and says, "We're from the government and we are here to help." Might not need to worry about that anymore. Just don't answer your Zoom. But we do need to worry about what the bureaucratic state does in its limited work week and from home or working remotely, wherever they're logging in at, because that's going to be the subject of our next connection, which is the impact of the administrative state these days. More people are picking up on what is being tagged as either regulation by strangulation or strangulation by regulation, depending on which word you prefer to put first. And it's pretty amazing that this is being done with most federal workers not even showing up at the office. In fact, it's scary. Now, how scary? Consider four recent climate change policy rules issued by the administrative state under President Biden. That's what Robert Bryce did recently on one of his excellent energy posts. And once I read that post, I almost didn't believe it at first. I had to check for myself going back to the Federal Register to believe what I was reading. And it was shocking, I tell you. So check this out. So there are just four rules that we're going to talk about. And this is just in the arena of tackling climate change when it comes to government regulation. So this is only a small subset of the whole of government these days. And none of these four rules that we're going to cover have explicit backing by statute that would have been passed by Congress, which is looking to be more and more unconstitutional now that the United States Supreme Court overturned one of the worst and most damaging decisions ever with what is known as the Chevron deference. But more on that in a minute. The total number of words in those four climate regs is, take a guess. Now, for context, before you put your guess in, a podcast episode of The Far Middle was which runs about 25 minutes, it's just under typically 4,000 words. And a book is, say, about 100,000 words. So how many words do you suppose are in those four climate regulations? The answer? 1.3 million. That's equivalent to about 13 books. And the four rules are spread across three government agencies. The first one saw earlier this year the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, issue a rule that it claims will, using its words, enhance and standardize climate-related disclosures by public companies and in public offerings. The final rules reflect the commission's efforts to respond to investors' demand for more consistent, comparable, and reliable information about the financial effects of climate-related risks on a registrant's operations. That's how the SEC put it. Now, the rule covers nearly 900 pages, has almost 300,000 words to it, which is about three books. Yeah, nice and light and straightforward. Going to create all kinds of transparency for investors, I'm sure. Then in mid-April, the EPA comes along. It issues a rule on tailpipe emissions from automobiles, which is, in practice, we've talked about this on prior episodes, a backdoor mandate for electric vehicles, EVs. Now, this rule runs over 350 pages in the Federal Register. Total word count, approaching 400,000, which is about four books. And the EPA wasn't done with its regulatory onslaught because the very next month, in early May, the EPA rule on emissions from power plants, that comes out and it sprawls at over 250 plus pages in the Federal Register. It contains over 300,000 words, three books, give or take there. Then about a week or so later, the FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, it wanted to get in on the fun, and so FERC published a rule about high voltage transmission lines that weaves together the power grid and lets the power grid work. The FERC rule, 1,300 plus pages, contains about 350,000 words. That's almost or about four more books, just shy of four more books. So here's a question for you to ponder. 1.3 million words for four rules within less than 6 months. And you add to that all the other rules and regs, whether in the arena of climate change policies or beyond, and ask how a business, a person, or an entity can comply with the law. Heck, how can one even know what the law says when it's this voluminous and complex? We've moved beyond absurd, but this is the environment the real economy has to operate in, and I don't think that's going to bode well for America. Fortunately, things may be changing with the sprawling administrative state. I mentioned the Supreme Court's overturning of its prior Chevron deference. It might be the biggest decision to benefit everyday Americans from the court in decades. And here's how a major law firm summed up the court's overturning and correcting from the flawed Chevron deference doctrine. The decision is a landmark holding of administrative law that will recalibrate the balance of power between agencies and courts. Its implications will likely be felt across virtually every federal agency. Yeah, I like that summation. And God willing, every American, I dare say. Now, let's conclude this episode with a nice connection that ties in our prior ones. We premiered on August 7th for this episode. We had a sports dedication involving two runners pushing each other onto greater feats. We discussed federal workers mailing it in and how not showing up in person to work hurts productivity and hurts creativity. And then we pivoted to how four massively complex administrative state regs were thrown upon doers and value creators in a few short months' time. Now, those themes, August 7, collaboration between greats in their field, how in-person work creates the spark, the magic of innovation, and what can be done in a short period of time. I think I've got a fitting closing connection, constant listeners, and it is a thing of beauty. It's a song, and the title of the song is If Not For You. Now, there are three popular versions from a short period of time, 1970 to 1971, each version special in its own right. The first and original version is from the legend who wrote the song, Bob Dylan, and it's from his October 1970 album, New Morning. It is a love song to Dylan's first wife, Sarah Dylan, and Dylan also recorded the song with George Harrison soon after the breakup of the Beatles. There's a version that the two of them performed in the studio. And that session of George Harrison and Bob Dylan working together, that attracted a lot of speculation in the music press at the time. And as an aside, guess who was the session bass player alongside Dylan and Harrison? Charlie Daniels. How about that? Now, speaking of George Harrison, in November of 1970, that's 1 month after the release of Dylan's album that had the original song, George Harrison released a version of If Not For You on his outstanding triple album, All Things Must Pass. And that's probably my favorite version of the three, but I do love all three versions. And speaking of three versions, the third version was the other well-known cover of Dylan's song. And this one was by Olivia Newton-John in 1971, using Harrison's arrangement for the most part of the song. Newton-John's outstanding version became her first hit single, and it peaked at the top of the easy listening charts on August 7th in the year 1971. So there you have it. Greats pushing greats to the next level, like Bannister and Landy running the mile. August 7th timing with Newton-John topping the charts. In-studio magic between Dylan and George Harrison that you won't get by Zoom or from your couch. And three beautiful versions in less than a year. A pace matching the not-so-beautiful administrative state's voracious appetite to appropriate the value of others with regulations. Nice way to close a fun episode. We will talk in a week. Until then, you stay connected to that far middle.